going to be talking about the Vietnam War. Now, this is, as you know, I'm quite old, but this is the only war I remember personally. I was born before the Korean War, but I was too young to remember this. I remember in the Vietnam War, it was just around the time I'd finished high school and I was in college at UCLA. And of course, people then were very concerned about getting out of the draft. They had conscription in those days. Of course, I was 4F. I didn't have to worry about that. But the doctor, I didn't even have to go for a regular physical. The doctor just took one look at me and realized I wouldn't fit in, so I didn't have anything to worry about there. But I do remember one story that was going around about someone who got been drafted and wanted to, and when he got to the barracks, he just, every piece of paper he could get his hands on, he would just pick up and say, "That isn't it." He would just pick up one paper after another. "That isn't it. That isn't it." He would empty out garbage cans in the barracks and would just look for a piece of paper and say, "That isn't it. That isn't it." So they were puzzled by what he was doing. After he'd been doing this for about a week, he just kept looking at these papers, picking up a piece of paper, saying, "That isn't it. That isn't it." They sent him to the Army psychiatrist for examination. So he went into the doctor's office. And again, he was picking up every paper in the doctor's office saying, "That isn't it, that isn't it." So then the doctor talked to him for a while and sent him back to his unit. And then he kept doing that. He would just pick up a piece of paper saying, "That isn't it, that isn't it." And after about another 2 weeks, he got an envelope in the mail and he opened it and it was a psychiatric discharge from the Army, and said, "That's it." Well, I thought it was funny. Anyway, okay, now, you remember when we were talking about World War II, and also in the lecture last week on the Cold War, I mentioned two different goals of American foreign policy in the two lectures. We're going to have to connect the World War II lecture and the lecture about the Cold War that we did last week. Now, you remember, during World War II, Franklin Roosevelt was very strongly opposed to empires. Remember, Winston Churchill was, of course, a great British imperialist. Churchill said very famously, "I have not become the king's first minister in order to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire." Of course, he did preside over the liquidation of the British Empire. But FDR was not interested in preserving the British Empire. On the contrary, he thought that the nations in the British Empire should become independent. And he also, remember, there was a French and colonial empire, and he thought that should become independent also. So FDR was definitely opposed to, he didn't want, after the war, assuming that the Allies were successful in defeating the Nazis, he didn't want a restoration of British and French empires. And this wasn't just peculiar to FDR. It wasn't just that FDR had these unusual attitudes that later presidents like Truman didn't hold. This was it was a theme in American foreign policy in the 1950s, that America, after all, was supposed to be representing democracy. Remember, going back to Woodrow Wilson, "The world must be made safe for democracy." So it didn't fit in very well with imperialism. So American foreign policy was opposed to the colonial empires. And to a large extent, one reason for this was that the American policymakers felt if these nations were independent, these former colonies were independent, that would give American businessmen a better opportunity to come in and maybe take over from the British or French. They could assume dominant commercial position. Now, that was one goal of American foreign policy. I remember, as we were talking about last week when we talked about the Cold War, another goal of American foreign policy in the years after World War II was containment of communism. Remember, this is a policy that George Kennan was the intellectual author of this policy. And this said the communist seems to be, communism had, especially under Russia, had big gains in World War II. They'd expanded, Russians had expanded into Eastern and Central Europe after their victory over the Germans, and China had fallen to the communists in 1949. So the dominant view in American policy then was it's bad if communism keeps spreading. We have to stop communism from spreading further. So in contrast to FDR, who'd been had quite a favorable view of Stalin, thought we could get along with Stalin. Truman, the president right after FDR, and also Eisenhower was the president who came after that, said, no, we can't get along with the communists. They're our enemies, so we've got to stop them from expanding further. Now, can you see how would these goals, I said there are these two goals, there's anti-colonialism, the policymakers who are opposed to the empires, preservation of empires, and their American policy also wants to contain communism. Now, before I shift to the next slide, can anyone tell me why would these two goals possibly come into conflict? You might think, well, can't we be opposed to communism and also not favor empires? Why might there be a conflict in these two goals? Have any takers on that? Here, let's see. Somebody said, Leslie said communists were leaders of independence in the colonies. Yes, this is exactly right. What happens if a colonialist power is fighting a communist independence movement? So on the one hand, we'd say, well, we don't want the colonialist power to defeat the independence movement because we're against empire, so we think the independence movement should win out. But on the other hand, we don't want communism to spread. So if we say, well, we're going to support the independence movement, or at least be neutral and not do anything, then we could be encouraging the spread of communism. But on the other hand, if we say, well, we're going to stop the communist movement from expanding, then we're going to be supporting the colonialist power that's fighting them. You see, because of these two goals don't have to conflict, but there's a possibility that they will in particular situations. And of course, this isn't just a hypothetical question. This actually came up in Vietnam. We had this situation where there's an independence movement that's communist dominated that's fighting against the French colonial power. Now, Vietnam had been a French colony since the mid-19th century. There were different parts of Vietnam, say, Cochin China, which I think is in the south, and Tonkin in the north, and they may have got that the wrong way around, I don't think so, but eventually Vietnam under the name French Indochina was a French colony for the latter part of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century as well. Now, at the time of World War II, remember the war broke out in September 1939, lasted until 1945, the nominal ruler was Bao Dai, who was the hereditary king. And the French didn't come in and just say, well, we're throwing out all the native Vietnamese government. It was really, they had a government, a Vietnamese government was kept in place. It was really the French in control. This is typical of the European imperialist power, say in India, princes and rajas who were in charge were not kicked out, they were kept in place, but the British were really in control. So similarly, in Vietnam, there was a hereditary king, Bao Dai, who was the nominal ruler. Now, a lot of the population respected his traditional position. He was, I think there had been about 9 kings in his line. Vietnam was a very traditional society, and people really looked up to the king. But many people also viewed him as weak. He was not a strong leader, and he tended to be interested in his personal life rather than ruling. In fact, he was a great womanizer. He had a lot of affairs with people, with various women. He spent a lot of time living in Paris rather than in Vietnam. He was also a big hunter. He liked to hunt lions and elephants. So he's not the most effective ruler in the world, to say the least. But he wasn't to be dismissed, because after all, he's the hereditary king. Now, after the German invasion of France in 1940, the Germans went into France. Remember, Germany and France are at war since the French declaration of war, September 30, 1939. And the Germans in 1940 were able to break through and rapidly overrun France. So the new French government, called the Vichy regime, because it was established in Vichy is a small town, it's a spa in France. It's called the Vichy regime under Marshal Philippe Pétain. This regime favored collaboration with the Germans, so they were the government in charge in France during World War II. Remember, the Japanese are allied with Germany in the Axis Pact. So they said to the French, remember, there's a French Governor General of Indochina. Indochina is still a French colony, even under this collaborationist government. So the Japanese said, well, we want to come in and station troops there. They didn't take over the country. The Japanese said, we want to station troops in French Indochina. So the Vichy Governor General really didn't have much choice, because he's not going to be able to defeat the Japanese army there. So he really had to approve. So we had a situation from 1940 to 45 where we have, it's kind of three things going on. There's a Vietnamese government under the King Bao Dai. There's really the French colonial regime, which is now the Vichy government. And you also had Japanese troops there who could, if they wanted, come in and take things over. But for most of the war, they didn't. However, in 1945, the Japanese took over and declared Vietnam independent. And King Bao Dai promoted himself. He now declared himself emperor. And he actually gave the country the name Vietnam. I think it's two words in Vietnamese. But remember, called French Indochina before that, but he now called it Vietnam and declared himself emperor. So this independent state didn't last very long because, remember, the Japanese lost the war. I think there were cases where a few soldiers, you heard reports 20 years later, there's part. Japanese soldiers didn't find out about the surrender, so there were cases where Japanese soldiers were found in various parts of the world who were still fighting because they hadn't heard the emperor had surrendered. But here, people did know this, that the Japanese had surrendered. So, of course, the French wanted to come back, but after the Japanese surrender, a pro-communist independence movement trying to take over the country, say it's kind of a power vacuum, the Japanese have surrendered, so they're not in charge, and the French are very weak because the Vichy government, of course, had been overthrown. The situation was very volatile in France, so there's a power vacuum. This pro-communist independence movement tried to take over the country, and this independence movement was called the Viet Minh. Now remember, at this time, there was the communists in China were fighting Chiang Kai-shek, trying to take over China, and they were eventually successful in doing that in 1949. So the communist Chinese supported the leader of this pro-communist independence movement, who's a very famous person, I'm sure most of you have heard of him, named Ho Chi Minh. So during World War II, they'd been giving Ho Chi Minh aid and helping him. And Ho Chi Minh was also in contact with the American OSS, that's Office of Strategic Services, which is the ancestor of the CIA. Now, sometimes you'll find people saying books about the Vietnam War, they'll say, well, look, America missed a big opportunity because Ho Chi Minh was very pro-American. He quoted from the American Declaration of Independence. So he missed a big chance. We should have supported him. But in fact, one time, some influential American people in the Secret Service did support him. He did have American contacts. So it's not, we didn't really turn a cold shoulder to him. We did have some support for Ho Chi Minh. Not exclusively, but to some extent. Now, as I say, the Viet Minh was led by Ho Chi Minh, who lived from 1890 to 1969. And he had been a longtime communist activist. In fact, had studied revolutionary tactics in Moscow. He'd been around for a long time. I think he worked actually as a chef in London. He was a pastry chef. I think he worked in America also as a chef. You know, it's funny, some political leaders had unusual occupations before they became famous, like Leon Trotsky, the famous Russian communist, was at one time a pants presser in Brooklyn, and Joachim von Ribbentrop, the Nazi foreign minister under Hitler, had been a champagne and wine salesman. So Ho Chi Minh was a pastry chef, but while he was out of the bakery, he was studying revolutionary tactics. So he was a leading communist activist. Now, there have been many disputes. If you look at these disputes going on when the Vietnam War was going on, people were disputing, said, well, was Ho Chi Minh primarily a communist, or was he interested in kind of promoting world revolution, or was he a Vietnamese nationalist? And I think it's clear the correct answer to that. He's both. He was both someone who thought that all the governments of the world should become communist. He supported the program of the Communist International, that we have that revolutionary overthrow of all the governments in the world and establishing communism everywhere. But he was also a strong Vietnamese nationalist. He was very much concerned with the independence of Vietnam, not just because he was a communist, but because he was a Vietnamese nationalist. So remember, Bao Dai has been emperor, the Japanese had overthrown the French government. They said, we want Vietnam to be independent member of their Greater East Asian co-prosperity sphere. But even though the Japanese had surrendered, Bao Dai was still emperor. So the Viet Minh kind of persuaded that sort of, not by talking to him, they weren't interested in having kind of a Hans Hoppe style rational discussion with him and get him to realize that if he didn't abdicate, he'd be involved in a foreign contradiction. They kind of pressured him to abdicate. It was clear if he didn't do it, they were going to kill him. They wanted him to abdicate and recognize Ho Chi Minh as the head of the Vietnamese government. And Bao Dai did this. He really didn't have any choice. But Bao Dai was able to escape from the communists. They kind of had him under very close observation, but there was a Chinese warlord who came in, and he somehow got control of Bao Dai and enabled him to fly out of the country. And as you would expect from Bao Dai, he went into exile in Paris. He really liked Paris. He was immensely wealthy, and he went over there. So the French, now that they were, we had a new French government after the war, they tried to regain control. Remember, they did not share the anti-imperialist views of FDR. They wanted French Indochina to remain under their control. So they tried to reestablish themselves in the southern part of Vietnam. And in the north, Ho Chi Minh had set up his own government under the communist government, was supported both by the Chinese communists and by the Russians, by the Soviets. So during the period from when the French came back, say around 45 to 46, through 1954, the French were fighting to establish control over Vietnam against the Viet Minh, which, remember, is this independence movement controlled by the communists. And they, in 1949, they brought Bao Dai, remember the emperor who'd abdicated, they brought him back not as emperor but as chief of state. But of course the people recognized him as the hereditary king. So the war was going on for a very long time, quite a number of years. And the French really made a major mistake. They thought, well, the communists are very good at guerrilla warfare, but if they can get the Viet Minh to fight a pitched battle, a major battle, like a traditional European-style battle, kind of Napoleon, they can get their army out and fight the Viet Minh army, then they can really put an end to this independence movement. Unfortunately, for them, they engaged this battle, Dien Bien Phu, it's a very famous battle, May 1954, but they were outsmarted by the Viet Minh because Viet Minh had knew that the French were going to have a battle there, so they lined the area with all sorts of artillery, would prevent the French from bringing in air support for their troops. They would be just shoot down the planes. So they were able to defeat the French army. It was a major defeat for the French army. They trapped the French army with very heavy artillery fire. Now the Viet Minh suffered big losses in this battle, but it was a very important victory for them. Now, America could probably have changed the outcome of Dien Bien Phu had they given the French air support, even though the Viet Minh had enough artillery to block the French from giving air support. Of course, American air power was much superior to French. So if the U.S. had wanted to, they could just have sent in a lot of air support and just blasted the Viet Minh. But they didn't do this. And you remember, why didn't they do this? And here we come back to what I was talking about at the start of the lecture. There's conflict between these two goals. On the one hand, America wants to stop communism, so this would give us reason to help the French. But on the other hand, we don't want the restoration of French colonial empire because we're anti-imperialists, we're supposed to be supporters of democracy. Democracy and imperialism don't really go together. So how did the Americans try to get out of this dilemma where we have two conflicting goals? We want to stop communism. On the other hand, we don't want to support French imperialism. So what the Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, I remember my great teacher, Walter Starkey, used to call him Dulist, E-S-T. But Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, remember, he'd been around for a long time. He was the author of the War Deal Clause, Article 231, Treaty of Versailles. So he said, well, there's a way we can get both goals, both the anti-imperialism and South and communism. He said, we could say to the French, we'll support you if you agree to give up Vietnam as a colony. So we'll give you military aid, but you have to agree to give up Vietnam. The French wouldn't agree to this. So here was one case then when anti-colonialism in American policy triumphed over anti-communism. We say, well, we're going to support the French only if they agree to Vietnamese independence, and they didn't do that. So after this victory of the Viet Minh at Dien Bien Phu, there was a conference held at Geneva in Switzerland that tried to settle the war. And at the conference, there were Russia, Britain, the U.S., France, and Red China were all there, so they were trying to come up with some agreement to end the war, which has been going on, remember, since 1945. So the way they, according to these Geneva Accords that settled the war, the conference recognized a government in the South, which was headed by Bao Dai, the chief of state, former emperor, the hereditary ruler of Vietnam, and a government in the north that was headed by Ho Chi Minh, the communist leader. However, this doesn't mean that the Geneva Accords were saying, well, okay, we're going to have two separate countries now, South and North Vietnam, just like we have South and North Korea. Sometimes in Vietnamese history, incidentally, there have been two independent countries, roughly constituted by North and South Vietnam now, but that wasn't what they were doing in the Geneva Accords. There was supposed to be an election in 1956, which was 2 years after the Geneva Conference, and this was going to choose a government for the entire country. Now, when 1956 came about, the South Vietnamese government refused to participate in such an election. They said, well, okay, these Geneva Accords, they were supposed to have an election, but the South Vietnamese government wouldn't agree to have the election. It was thus never held. And they said, well, the South Vietnamese said, we didn't sign these accords saying that we're going to have the election. the U.S. didn't sign the accords either. And if they'd had an election, because of the communist control of the North, there were roughly, I think, about 15 million people in the North and about the same number in the South. But remember, the North is totally under the control of the communists. So if you had voting, it would be pretty clear that Ho Chi Minh was going to win. They could say, well, maybe they could have free elections, but you know, the communists weren't going to really allow that. So it was pretty clear that the South Vietnamese were making it, if they wanted to remain non-communist, it was clear they couldn't go ahead with these elections because of the just ensure victory for Ho Chi Minh. Now, sometimes you'll see in various books, they'll say, well, this shows that Ho Chi Minh was really popular, but it doesn't really, it just shows that the communists are very good at imposing a totalitarian government. Now, I gotta say that there were people who liked Ho Chi Minh in the South. I mean, it's clear that the reason he would have won the election is just because the communists were don't really allow free choices. Now if you introduce another very important figure, Ngo Dinh Diem, he became the prime minister of South Vietnam at the time of the Geneva Accords. The French wanted, sort of insisted that Bao Dai bring Diem in as the prime minister of South Vietnam. Now, according to Hilaire Duperrier, who's the author of one of the great, I think one of the best books on Vietnam War, the early stages of Vietnam War, called Background to Betrayal, came out in 1965, so it just covers the onset of the American participation in the war, not the later events. And according to Duperrier, he was appointed due to pressure from American liberals and socialists who were interested in Vietnam. I should say I met Duperrier on one occasion. He was a very kind of a comical looking person. He had kind of a face looked like a pancake, but he'd been around a very long time. He'd been in the Spanish Civil War, I think he'd been in the Ethiopian War, he'd been a spy for the French during World War II, so he really was kind of an international adventurer, a very colorful character. I think he lived until his late 90s, but he was very well informed on everything that was going on in Vietnam. So he said, well, there were a lot of American liberals who were socialists who thought Diem would be very good. They thought, well, he's going to be a progressive. And one of the people who supported him actually was Senator John F. Kennedy, who was a member of this group called American Friends of Vietnam. Now, Diem had been around, he'd been an administrator for the French in the French colonial government, I think in the 1930s, but he and Bao Dai didn't get along. He was someone who, Diem was someone who didn't like taking orders from anyone, and he didn't really defer to the emperor, the former emperor, and he really wanted to put his own family in power. So what he did when he was prime minister in 1954, so he called for a plebiscite on whether South Vietnam should be a republic in 1955. And probably from the point of view of fighting the communists, this was a mistake because, remember, the monarchy had a lot, even though Bao Dai wasn't personally that respected, the monarchy had a big basis in Vietnamese tradition, so this is kind of weaken the structure of society. But the plebiscite resulted in people voting, majority vote for a republic, was kind of rigged by Diem, so we can't really think that that was, can't really trust that. It was like these votes when they're Hitler, you know, where 99.5% of the people approve the government policy, you can't really take that altogether seriously. Now, DiEM, as I said, had been, he was a very experienced and skillful administrator, but he had a kind of a cold and forbidding personality. He wasn't a very kind of a popular person. He wasn't somebody that everybody liked. He was kind of considered quite moody and kept to himself. However, in spite of his deficiency, in spite of his getting rid of Baladai, he appeared to be holding his own for a while against the communist guerrilla forces. They were now called the Viet Cong, in Sanskrit Vietnamese, communists who were fighting to take over South Vietnam. Viet Cong received support from North Vietnam, the Ho Chi Minh government, and they were controlled by the North Vietnamese communists. So we had this war going on between the Viet Cong, the communist movement trying to take over South Vietnam, and the Diem government. So here's a problem. You know, this course is on real causes of America's wars. So we have a problem now is what we've so far described as a Vietnamese civil war. We have, there's the Diem government, successor to the French colonial government. We have a Ho Chi Minh communist government, North Vietnam. And the communists are trying to take over the South. Of course, Diem would have liked to have taken over North Vietnam if he could, but he wasn't able to. So question is, well, why should the U.S. care about this? Why should we have gotten involved? How did this become an American war? Jeff described so far, it's a Vietnamese war. So how do we get this into a court? Why does this belong in a course on America's war? Remember, South Vietnam was a small country of very little strategic importance. We could say, from the American point of view, we could say what Neville Chamberlain said about Czechoslovakia, probably wrongly, but Neville Chamberlain said about Czechoslovakia, it's a faraway country of which we know nothing. And certainly in 1954, most Americans probably never heard of Vietnam. We could say what happens there, of course, very important to people over there, but it doesn't really matter that much. We might say, well, wouldn't it be bad if the communists took over there? Well, certainly be bad for the Vietnamese having a communist government there. A government isn't very good for the people over there, but how would preventing the communists from taking over help defend America? Now, further, there's a further reason why Americans should avoid getting involved, which would be very relevant time. Remember, from the lecture last week, when we talked about the Korean War, we had this great war going on for 1951-53, we had a lot of American troops there that we hadn't been able to win. The war had been fought to a stalemate. So it seemed like a pretty good idea that we Americans should avoid a land war in Asia. They don't tend to work out very well. Now, the President Eisenhower, remember, he had been the supreme Allied commander in Europe in World War II. He didn't want to send in American troops. He agreed, well, we shouldn't have a land war in Asia, so he doesn't want to send American troops into Vietnam. But he didn't say, well, okay, we don't want the communists to take over, but you know, there's nothing we can really do about it. We don't want to get involved. But he was very worried that a communist victory in Vietnam might lead to communist victories in other parts of Asia. And this is the famous domino theory. But the idea of domino theory is they imagine you have a number of dominoes that are kind of standing up. You have them kind of in a row, they're all standing up in a row, and you knock one over, it'll knock over all the others. So the idea is, well, if you let Vietnam become communist, then other countries like Laos and Cambodia, other small countries, will also fall to communism. And then if the communists control China and Southeast Asia, this could threaten Japan and eventually the U.S. So this is the domino theory. Says, well, we shouldn't say what happens in this small country, Vietnam, isn't of concern to us. If communism triumphs there, then we could be in serious trouble. Now, I think there, you can see there are a lot of problems with this domino theory. We have to consider first, even on its own terms, the domino theory doesn't work. Now, it seems likely that if a particular nation like Vietnam becomes communist, this will aid in efforts to communize its neighbors because then it can get support from the communist countries. And, you know, you could have kind of a bandwagon effect. But the pressure doesn't have to be irresistible. We don't have, I mean, there's no reason to think that it's going to be some kind of automatic process, just like with the fallen dominoes. If one nation falls to communism, all the others are going to fall. Also, it just depends, whether a nation becomes communist will depend primarily on internal developments in the particular country. Also, when what this theory is suggesting, and we're taking it on its own terms, is saying, well, if the communists succeed in getting control over Southeast Asia, it's going to be a big threat to America. So this theory is assuming, well, if you have a communist government in control of all different countries, it will be a united communist bloc against us. But this ignores rivalries among communist nations. For example, in 1978, after several years after the Vietnam War ended, Vietnam invaded Cambodia, which was another communist state. Remember, under the famous Khmer Rouge, was a very brutal regime. And in 1979, China invaded Vietnam and seized some territory in the north, and they just left the country, so the fact that you have communist nations doesn't ensure they're all going to be united against America. So there's an additional problem with the domino theory. Now, this even more problems with domino theory. It really isn't a very good theory. The theory falls just like a pack of dominoes. Another problem is the theory assumes that once a nation goes communist, it will remain communist. So saying, well, we have to avoid these nations all falling into communism because then we'll have these united bloc communist nations against us. But why should we think if a nation becomes communist and it's going to stay that way? Remember, George Kennan, who was the author of the Containment Doctrine, didn't make this mistake. He thought eventually the communism is not a sustainable system, it's going to collapse. Incidentally, Kennan didn't think containment of communism in Asia was important at all. He didn't think Asia was a vital concern. What happened in Asia wasn't really a vital concern to American security. And we can see from the famous socialist calculation argument of Ludwig von Mises, where Mises showed that a socialist economy can't really calculate economically, so it's bound to collapse eventually. If you get it along for a while, they rely on capitalist prices. Eventually, they're going to have a lot of problems, and they won't be able to keep going. And this is, of course, what actually happened in communism. It did collapse, so this is an additional problem for the domino theory. Now, another problem, I'm going on about the Gamma theory a lot because it was very important in accounting for why America got involved in Vietnam. People were afraid that it's going to be really bad if the communists take over. Another problem with the theory is the communist governments aren't always hostile. To take a most obvious case, the U.S. and Vietnam, which is under the communist government, remember, as we'll see later on the lecture, the communists took over the whole country in 1975, and they've been in control ever since. The U.S. and Vietnam now get along pretty well, so this theory has wrongly said that first that all the communist governments are going to be united against us, ignoring rivalries among the communist parties. It is also assuming falsely that communist governments are going to be always hostile to the U.S. But suppose we set aside these two dubious assumptions. Suppose we say, well, okay, supposing things happen just as Domino Theory says, we have this block of communist nations in Southeast Asia who are all against us. So assuming all these criticisms of the Domino Theory are wrong. Well, let's imagine that the communists seize control of large parts of the world. It isn't the case that this need pose any threat to America's safety. We obviously prefer that this not happen. We don't like communism for good reason. But this need not be a threat to American safety. This is parallel to the point made by the 1930s isolations, where the people favored intervention in Europe. So, well, look, what if Hitler gets control of Europe? So the isolation said, well, we wouldn't like that, but we can still defend America. Remember, America, especially after World War II, was the most powerful nation in the world and richest nation, and we're certainly in a good position to defend ourselves. So the peril of Domino Theory is pointed really wasn't severe as its advocates were contending. So to get back to the situation in Vietnam at this time, as I said earlier, the Diem government for a while seemed to be holding its own against the Viet Cong. Diem was a very good administrator and he had some programs that were quite good for the people liked. He wasn't just someone everybody hated, but he wasn't popular either because he suppressed dissent and he kept power within his family. And his brother was Ngo Dinh, was Ngu, and the famous Madam Ngu, who was Ngu's wife. And they kept almost all the important offices went to members of his family or his brother's family. So he really was somebody who kind of tried to control everything himself. Also, Diem was a Roman Catholic, and there was a Catholic minority in Vietnam, but the Buddhists, who were probably the dominant group, there were other religions also. There were various sects, there were animists and Taoists and others, but the Buddhists were many more Buddhists than Catholics. They claimed that Diem was discriminating against them. And there were incidents they would be at various Buddhist religious holidays. The Buddhist pagodas wanted to put out their own flags, and Diem said they couldn't do that, and then the Buddhists were very upset because they said, well, the Catholics have been allowed to put out flags on their religious holidays. They had all sorts of big demonstrations about it, and this attracted a lot of attention because there were a few cases where Buddhist monks set themselves on fire in protest. They committed suicide. A Buddhist monk would just kneel down the street and they'd have someone pour gasoline over him and they just set him on fire. So, as you can imagine, this is a lot of tension. I see Leslie asked a question, how was DM on economic policy? Well, he was somewhat of a, kind of a, remember he was supported by American liberals, he somehow kind of was trying to establish various government programs with some kind of land reform, not as, he wasn't extensive government intervention for communists, but he was more or less kind of trying to put in certain government programs. He was very concerned, of course, with advancing the interests of his own family. But because of the war, he really didn't have a really chance to put in a whole lot of economic measures. I mean, there were some, as I say, I think he built schools and various hospitals and did other things. And it turned out the American ambassador to Vietnam, Henry Cabot Lodge, was the grandson of the Senator Lodge, the friend of Theodore Roosevelt, who proposed Woodrow Wilson's League of Nations after World War I. He strongly opposed Diem. Now, President Kennedy was very uncertain what he should do. We had the ambassador and various other people saying Diem is very unpopular, he's got to go. And then other people said, no, well, we need Diem, he's the one who's running the government. So, Kennedy tended to be indecisive, but eventually he approved a military coup against Diem. The generals, certain Vietnamese generals, arrested Diem and he was killed. His brother-in-law his brother was killed also. This happened in November 1963, which ironically the same month that Kennedy was assassinated. Now, from the point of view of U.S. policy, the Diem coup was probably a mistake. It's hard to say, although it was true, Diem was unpopular. But on the other hand, he was running the government. And after the generals got rid of him, there was a big period of instability. You had various people trying to take over. And the Viet Cong made quite big advances. So at this time, the U.S. had about 16,000 so-called military advisors in Vietnam. They weren't officially fighting, but actually they were. I remember one comedian at the time, I remember this, said something like, well, we have advisors in Vietnam. The advisors just dropped 10,000 tons of advice on Vietnam. So, this number of soldiers, these advisors, it wasn't enough to enable the South Vietnamese army, which wasn't very good, to hold off the Viet Cong. So now the U.S. had an important decision to make. They could say, well, if we want to stop the Viet Cong from taking over in North Vietnamese from establishing a unified government over Vietnam, we can send in a lot more troops. Or you could say, well, we don't want to do that. We don't want to get involved in a land war in Asia. It's a big mistake of what happened in Korea. So we could say, well, we're going to withdraw. We don't like the Vietnamese communists taking over, but it was not worth the cost to us to try to stop them, given what would be required to stop, we just can't pay that price. Now, there's a great deal of controversy about what Kennedy would have done had he not been assassinated. Now, there's one view that he would have decided to withdraw American troops. And probably the very interesting view, kind of an extreme version of this view, is in a book by James W. Douglas called JFK and the Unspeakable. And what Douglas claims, he's been interviewed by the Rockwell, kind of an interesting writer. He's a pacifist, and he's also just kind of Catholic theologian. He claims that the CIA had Kennedy killed because he wanted to end the Cold War. So it's a very controversial claim, but it's an interesting one. I'm not endorsing it or rejecting it. I just thought I'd mention it. But if we want to answer the question, what would Kenny have done, we really can't say, because Kenny was very often indecisive. So he can quote, people quoted various statements that he made that seems like he might have considered withdrawing, but we can't really be sure about that. And of course, as it turned out, his successor was Vice President Lyndon Johnson, decided to escalate the war. And when he did this, we had, within a few years, a full-scale war. It wasn't just we had these advisors in, 60,000 fighters. Eventually, around 490,000 troops were sent to Vietnam. I think around 58,000 Americans who were killed in the war. And in this decision for escalation, the famous Gulf of Tonkin incident played a big, some role. What LBJ claimed, Lyndon Johnson claimed, was that North Vietnamese torpedo attacks had attacked the USS Maddox, which is an American ship, the station in waters there in Vietnam. They attacked them with torpedoes, attacked the ship on August 2nd, 1964. Now, it turned out this claim wasn't true. It was kind of, they didn't really have any evidence that the Vietnamese boats had attacked the American ship. But nevertheless, on August 7th, Congress passed the Gulf, which should be of, not on, Tonkin. Resolution authorizing the president to take, quote, all necessary measures to take over, to repel the communists. And I see a question from Malcolm, were there any economic interests for the U.S. and Vietnam? Well, there were some, but I don't think it wasn't really a major resource base. I think there's some people think there were significant economic interests, but probably that wasn't the main reason for American intervention. Now, although this Gulf Tonkin resolution incident is very important, I don't think we should exaggerate the importance. There's some people who say, well, this is what got us into the war. Some people like this kind of idea of false flag operations. They look in the war between Germany and Poland in 1939, the Germans dressed up certain prisoners as Polish soldiers so they could say that Poland invaded Germany. So this is, and the Germans declared war, so it's a defensive operation. They said, well, look here, we're fabricating an attack in North Vietnamese so we can go in an attack. But I think this was something that took place. I don't think it's the most important thing. Probably LBJ would have been able to get Congress to approve escalation without it, because we were very concerned at the time with stopping the communists, or at least going into why what LBJ's reasoning was. So I think just it's a parallel in World War II. We shouldn't exaggerate the importance of it. With dressing up the prisoners as Polish soldiers, it's clear Germany would have invaded Poland even without that. I just mention that because I think there are some people who pull into this. I've seen this on some of the discussions in the Media Institute various blogs. Some people really like, I think they attach too much importance to this false flag theory. Maybe people will challenge me about this in the discussion. Yes, I think Tony pointed out there was some rubber, but I don't think that was the most significant factor getting into the war. It was something to be considered, though, you're right. So what was the reason, the principal reason, why LBJ and his advisors, such as Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, and then you know what McNamara's middle name is? It's Strange. He was another strange person. So why did the advisors get in? Well, it wasn't that they were optimistic that South Vietnam could win. They recognized that the South Vietnamese army was very weak and it would be a very difficult thing to win the war. Rather, the main argument was that if we abandon Vietnam, we said, well, look, we don't want to get involved, then American credibility would suffer. And credibility is an extremely important concept in American foreign policy theorizing. If you read various political scientists, Innes Claude was one who was writing about it. Credibility is extremely important. The idea here was America had made substantial commitments to various allies. We had all sorts of treaties saying to the British and French, will come to the NATO countries, will come to your aid if Russia invades Europe, and made commitments to all sorts of countries. So if other nations thought we won't keep our commitments, then America's power and security would be adversely affected. So in understanding this view, we have to distinguish credibility from prestige. And the point of the credibility argument isn't how esteemed the U.S. It isn't, the argument isn't, it, well, if we withdraw, then people kind of say, ha ha, look what happened to you. You thought you were this big power and you're going to stop the Vietnamese from taking over. We're making fun of you. Can't do that. It isn't that people would lose esteem for the U.S., although that could happen. But the key is how much other nations will rely on U.S. commitments. So the idea is, well, we're not, other nations aren't going to rely on us. Now, on its own terms, it's questionable how much a single withdrawal would affect all other commitments. There's kind of a domino theory for commitments, just like we have a domino theory that one nation falls to communism, all these other nations are going to fall. Here the view is, well, if we don't keep one commitment, then all these other commitments are going to fall also. So that's unlikely to happen. After all, some commitments are very important. It was very important in American foreign policy to preserve Western Europe independence. So they're not going to say, well, the U.S. had to get out or decide to withdraw from Vietnam, so then they're not going to help us either. So credibility argument is making a questionable assumption about the effect of withdrawal on other commitments. And then one point I see, what was it, who's the person here? Malcolm has already made this point, it's a very good point. The credibility argument assumes that it's desirable for the U.S. to have extensive commitments to other countries, but it's mentioned before, this assumption that American security depends on a friendly world. If we have all these, we can't have all these hostile countries against it. That's questionable. America could defend itself regardless of what the country, other countries did, or what kind of regimes they put in. This is, again, the same argument we've already discussed when we were talking about the domino theory. Also, there's an additional point is, considering the devastation the war brought to Vietnam, other nations might not welcome an American commitment. Other nations say, well, if this is what American commitment involves, we don't want any. I think someone has put in, Tony thinks that rubber is very important. Well, it could well be, but you know, then you can, again, you have to ask, well, how much are we willing to risk to get control of the rubber? So in 1968, the North Vietnamese decided to launch an all-out attack on South Vietnam, which was called the Tet Offensive. Tet is the Vietnamese religious holiday. There's supposed to be a truce during this religious holiday, but Congress thought they'd get a surprise attack going. And they took the communists took very heavy losses in this attack, but the attack led many in the United States, as big anti-war movement, that many people thought the war is hopeless, even though the communists had lost a lot. They said, well, a lot of the American opinion was, well, look, we've been fighting this war for years, and now the communists are going into these major cities. They looked like they were taking over. They were pushed back, but they looked like they're doing pretty well, so maybe the war seems to be not going well. So the new president, remember, LBJ decided not to run because the Tet Offensive was done so well, and his Vietnam policy was very unpopular, so he decided not to run for re-election in 1968. The new president was Richard Nixon. Nixon decided to withdraw American troops and to substitute South Vietnamese troops. Instead, he said, well, war won't be so unpopular if we don't have American troops, if we reduce the number of American troops. And he accompanied this plan by bombing North Vietnam, which hadn't been done that much before, and also bombing Cambodia, which was one of the neighboring states. The Viet Cong and North Vietnamese, the Chinese, the Russians had been able to ship supplies into the Viet Cong through what's called the Ho Chi Minh Trail, part of which went through Cambodia, so Nixon just bombed that. December 1972, the famous Christmas bombing, which attacked Hanoi and Haiphong. So Nixon had kind of a dual policy, was withdrawing American troops, but he was also taking the fight somewhat to North Vietnam by bombing them. And what he wanted to do was kind of have some kind of agreement where there'd be an independent South Vietnamese government that could be maintained with American aid. So North Vietnam, South Vietnam, the Viet Cong, and the U.S. signed a peace agreement in January 1973. I think American troops were supposed to be withdrawn within 60 days of this agreement was done. And the North Vietnamese troops, though, who were in the South, weren't required to leave, but they were supposed to promise not to undertake offensive operations. Of course, they didn't keep that promise. So at this time, remember, this was the famous Watergate scandal. Nixon got into a lot of trouble. So Congress had turned against Nixon, and there wasn't much aid given to South Vietnam. Nixon had wanted a lot of aid to be given to the South Vietnamese government, but Congress didn't go along with that. And Saigon, which was the capital, fell to the communists in April 1975, and Vietnam has been a communist country since then. Okay, so I've gone a little bit over time, so I think we'll stop the lecture now, and I'm going to go to the let me just see if there's anything in the chat I need to talk about. I don't think so. I see some people think economic interests were the most important. I really doubt that, and there is no reason to be for that. Okay, so I'm going to the Q&A section now, so if you have questions, objections, please type them in there. Okay, now Tony said, to what degree might Islam be friendly of communism in Southeast Asia and Malaysia, or is this irrelevant? The reason I ask is that if they're willing to defend their religious freedom, they would lose this under communism. And Tony said, my previous question, I should have said Indonesia, not Malaysia. Well, I think this is, you're right, that is one of the competing ideologies. So I think you're right, that is, and it was an important factor there, and I mean, that is, certainly was very important in Afghanistan, that was one of the main sources of resistance to the Russians. So I think you're right, that is a very important factor. Patricia said, are any other classes being offered on more recent conflict? Well, that's a possibility. I mean, I'm going to be teaching my logic class again next. We're still trying to figure out what else I should teach. Of course, I offered selected points in my life, but I don't think that, and also history of professional wrestling, I don't think those would go over. So what you're suggesting is certainly one possibility. Zachary says, how much was Russia interested in the region along with Armstead? What was their involvement in the war? Well, their principal involvement was they were sending a lot of arms, not Russian soldiers, they were sending a lot of arms to North Vietnam, and in fact, they, one thing they were very interested in, they wanted to be the dominant communist power there, not China. They didn't want the Chinese to be the main ones who were supporting the North Vietnamese, because it was quite a rivalry going on, saying a Sino-Soviet split began in the early 1960s. So this big rivalry between Russia and China, so they were interested mainly in promoting their own power there. And Malcolm said, Jackson 88 wrote, the credibility argument might have been the esoteric argument. The esoteric argument was probably rent-seeking through defense contract. To what extent did the defense industry exert pressure for war in Vietnam? Well, as I mentioned, there are some people who do kind of interpret American foreign policy primarily in terms of economic interest, and certainly there were important certain defense industries made a lot of profit. But I tend, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I tend to be someone who looks at foreign policy in kind of old-fashioned, mainly as a matter of struggles for political power. I'm not an economic determinist. So I tend to think, what is rent seeking through defense contracts and rubber interest is very important. I tend to doubt that that was the dominant controlling factor. I mean, maybe I haven't done enough reading on the point, but that's why I'm inclined to see it now. Now, Brian says, why do you think Americans still trust the government even after the Kent State massacre? Well, of course, some people don't trust the government. I don't think we should. But I guess people would think that's an isolated incident, or they say that we have a different government now. There was a very unsettled period. Some people would say, well, things are more settled now. Of course, there were some people who thought these protesters had to be suppressed, so not everybody turned against the government after the Kent State massacre. Now, Peter says, what were the French interests in Vietnam? Why were they went back after World War II? Well, remember, France thought of itself as a great power, and they'd had this as part of their empire. Remember, Algeria, they had colonies all in various parts of Africa, Asia. They didn't want to give up what they had before. I mean, just we could say, why does the U.S. say want to be in control of American Samoa or Guam? You know, don't seem like they're very important. Nations don't really like to give up things. Now, there were various people in France who weren't that anxious to keep the empire. In fact, in 1954, the French premier was Pierre Mendès France, and what he wanted to do was sort of get out, but he wanted it to be on terms that wouldn't, kind of face-saving terms where the communists wouldn't take over. So not all the French did want to get it back, but many of them did. Remember, there was a very well-established imperial bureaucracy. There were soldiers who had long-standing interest in that area, so they wanted to, they just thought, well, now the war is over, we can go back to where we were before. Well, I should say one thing. The reason, remember in your reading for the, this week, I put in an article by, short article by Murray Rothbard. And the reason I put this in is that Murray Rothbard has often been subjected to a smear campaign. I think Tom Palmer is one of those who said this. He said, well, Rothbard really like the North Vietnamese. He was very happy that the North Vietnamese took over South Vietnam in April 1975. But of course he wasn't. He was very opposed to the North Vietnamese. But he said what he thought was good was he said the fall of Saigon shows how a state can collapse. So that was that was why I said this. So I just put that article so you can get some idea of what Rothbard was writing. I'm writing to any essays or books in the work. Well, I'd like to do what I've been working on. I'm supposed to have done this. I'm very late. I'm very late in all my work. I'm supposed to do an essay with my friend Ronald Hanway on Robert Nozick's Derivation of the Minimal State. We have some ideas on what's wrong with that. So that would be one possibility. And then I have a lot of book reviews. I'm very behind in my book reviews, so I want to try to get some of those out. This teaching is keeping me quite busy, and so, you know, sort of I'm kept a bit scattered, but I have to get concentrated. And Tony says, Barry Goldwater is often quoted Dorf as libertarian views, but wasn't he really hawkish on communism? Yes, that's right. I mean, his view was, see, at the time, American strategy was said, well, even though we're fighting, maybe I should go into this in the lecture, even though we're fighting various wars against the communist Vietnam, we have to be very careful not to go in with everything we've got. Because if we do that, remember, the Soviets have all these atomic weapons, we don't want to get a nuclear war started. So Goldwater was somebody who tended to downplay that. I think he said, you know, we could go in, necessarily we should go all out, maybe even use nuclear weapons. And I remember people used to say, one of the jokes going around was, if Goldwater had been elected president, his inaugural address would have been 10, 9, 8, 7. That was actually one of the jokes going around at that time. Okay, now Patricia says, don't take a break teaching. I greatly enjoy all your classes. See you this year. Thank you. Oh, well, automatic A for Patricia in this course. Okay, you don't see it. Is anybody put in? Oh, here's one. Ryan says, what is your favorite book or essay is available on Mises.org? Do you mean something like anything on the site that's the best, or just something that I did, or what do you mean? I think if you're asking more what I did. Oh, anything on the site. Well, I mean, I suppose I would probably pick Murray Rothbard's History of Economic Thought is one best. Human Action, Can't Go Wrong with Man, Economy, and State. You know, I think I get it down maybe to those three. There are all sorts of other ones also. But, you know, if there's so much value on that site, so you can get it, download it for free. I shouldn't say you can't beat that price, because you can imagine a situation where people pay you to read something, but it's really a good deal if you're getting it for free. I should say, when I mentioned Hilaire du Barrier, I'll tell you a joke involving him. It doesn't show me in a very good light. See, Hilaire du Barrier lived in Monaco, and he thought very highly of the ruling family there. Remember, Prince Rainier and Princess Grace, who had been the American actress Grace Kelly. So, Grace Kelly had died. I think she was in an accident. She had a stroke when she was driving there. And I told someone a really awful joke about this, which was, what's the national anthem of Monaco? And the answer is, she'll be coming around the mountain when she comes. So, a friend of mine told this joke to Hilaire du Barrier, and du Barrier said, "We are not amused." So kind of embarrassed this friend of mine, one of my greatest friends. So I was responsible for, I was the one who was responsible for that joke, but du Barrier blamed a friend of mine. But he really did have a face that looked like a pancake. Let me just see if anyone's put anything on the chat that I missed. Let me just go to that. Wait a sec here. Somebody wants pro wrestling, good. Now, Leslie has a question here. Weren't the proponents of escalation, such as Ruskin, McNamara, Kennedy appointees, did Robert Kennedy support the escalation? I think, yes, the Ruskin, McNamara have been Kennedy appointees. Now, I'm not sure on Robert Kennedy's views. I think he was tended to be more critical of the Vietnam War, but I don't think he would come out really. I think he was somewhat critical, but I don't think he'd come out for outright withdrawal, but he was a strong critic of LBJ. Now, what Jackson says, what is the most accurate description of the U.S. as a political entity currently? Well, I'd probably say a military corporate controlled entity with some tinctured democracy in as well. Corrupted democracy, that's not bad. Now, Tony says, I love what is government into our money. That's one of Rothbard's great pamphlets. Everybody should read it. I remember it very well when it came out in 1963. It shows you how old I am. But I remember that it was put out by the Freedom School, published by the Freedom School of Bob LaFave. Of course, it's come out in many editions since that time. And Jackson says, well, we still have 6 minutes left. Tony laughed at one of my jokes. Good. That story means going to be on well, and will be censored. Okay, so let's see. Did I miss anything else? Okay, so we're back to the Q&A now. So we still have about another 6 minutes or so. Not that I'm a clock watcher. Granted, what if you had to pick one text from Walter Block? Well, I think his Defending the Undefendable is a very good and provocative book. I think that's a very good one. He has a volume of essays on labor economics that's very good. I did a review of that. I think he's someone who's always worth reading. He's very, very good, great libertarian, and very nice person. Also, I've known him a very long time. Now, Brian says you should open up a library with all the books behind you. Well, that's been suggested. Of course, the books you see is just a very short, very small number of the ones I have. You should see the rest of this room. I hope you can't, but I can't find what I need to read some of it. I don't have enough room. I live in a fairly small apartment, and I don't have enough room to sort out all my books, unfortunately. Well, I'll tell you one other funny story about Hilaire Dubarry. Now, I think Dubarry was really knowledgeable person. He really knew a great deal. Murray Rothbard didn't think that highly of me. I think he kind of missed him kind of an intellectual lightweight. So I remember once, I think I said to Murray, I said, did you want to get into a discussion with Hilaire Dubarry? And we're saying, no, I don't think so. No, thank you. Yeah, Hilaire Dubarry used to call him H. Dubé. Now, Malcolm has a question. Previous lecture, before the war, the Southern per capita income was about 80%, Northern per capita income. After the war, was only about 40%, and took about 100 years after 85 to the 80% level to be reached. Malcolm asked, did the per capita income include slaves or just white males? So the total population, meaning the slaves, including the per capita, is sharing with slave owners. Well, I'd have to check that, but I would think it wouldn't include slaves. They would be considered part of the income. They wouldn't be considered part of it. I mean, they wouldn't be what you'd be dividing the income among. They would be just considered economic asset. I'd have to check that to be sure that. It's a good question, but I have to look at the statistics to give you a make sure of my answer, but I would think the slaves wouldn't be included. That's a very good question. Of course, it's unfair to ask questions on previous lectures because I forget everything after each lecture. Yes, I used to have a fairly good memory, but not anymore. Malcolm, I was just kidding when I said don't ask about a previous lecture. You know, I was just making a joke. I don't really forget the previous lecture. It was just a joke. By all means, ask anything you like. I was just kidding. Sorry, I didn't make that clear. is, I sometimes got in trouble making remarks. I kind of just jokes and people take them too seriously. I had the reverse problem where I make what I consider a serious remark and people think I'm joking. That happened to me once at a conference. Okay, now, Malcolm, did anyone know of any writings during the adoption of the Constitution? Speaker of State tried to see any links. Well, that actually wasn't discussed all that much, but there was something, I think, in the Virginia and New York ratifying conventions. I mean, I think people said when they were ratifying, they said they had the right to leave if things didn't work out. And I think you can look at Kevin Gutzman, G-U-T-Z-M-A-N, has written about that. You can look him up on the media site, G-U-T-Z-M-A-N. Well, I think we've come not only to the end of today's lecture, but we've come to the end of the course, and I want to thank everybody for listening to me enrolling in my course, and I hope that you'll consider enrolling in future courses if what I've said in this course hasn't deterred you. And thanks, everybody. And I have, there'll be one more quiz that I'll be sending in, and that this is the last lecture. So thanks, everybody, and I hope we'll be seeing you again soon. Thank you. I hope everybody has a happy holiday. Happy New Year. Bye, everybody. Thank you.